From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Can a racist and a neo-Nazi change her ways?
It was like, well, all I have to do is say, join in and say, I hate black people, I hate Jews, I hate all non-white people.
On Second Thought is celebrating its third anniversary. This show first went on the air October 20th in 2014. So we're marking the occasion by listening back to some of the best conversations we've had. Today we talked to a former skinhead about what pulled her out of hate. We'll also hear from Killer Mike about his favorite Georgia music, and comedian Colin Mochrie makes frequent appearances in Atlanta.
Anyone can do improv. I mean, all our lives are improvised. So basically the two rules are doing the things that we don't do in real life, which is listening and accepting other people's ideas. That is the hardest hurdle for new improvisers to get over. There's that thing, and that's where, no, my idea is better. And once you learn to let that go, you can be a good improviser.
We always want to know what you think, and we'd love to hear about what conversations have really stuck with you. When was your driveway moment? Let us know. And another great way to make your voice heard is to become a supporter of this show and of GPB. We're in the midst of our fall fund drive. This is a perfect opportunity to not only say, I love this show, but also that this show deserves support from the community it serves. So take a couple minutes of your time to give at gpb.org. It's not just Charlottesville. There have been a number of rallies around the country in which neo-Nazis marched with swastika flags. That's left many people wondering how a person could end up marching to support hatred and racial inequality. Shannon Martinez of Athens can shed some light on that. She was a skinhead for several years, but she's not one anymore. We spoke to Shannon earlier this year, and a note to our listeners, parts of this conversation may not be suitable for young ears.
Good morning.
Now, Shannon, you actually joined a skinhead group when you were a teenager, right? Quite young.
Yes, when I was in between 15 and 16 years old.
So let's walk through what happened then and how you ended up joining that group. Because as I understand it, you yourself considered yourself to be liberal at that point.
When we would sit around the dinner table, my family tended towards much more conservative politics and arguments, whereas I took the much more liberal view. I loved the Beatles as a middle schooler and the culture of the 60s.
Your family, I'm sorry to interrupt,
sure.
You described your family as having acceptable middle-class racism. What does that mean?
I don't mean that from a personal point of view at this point in my life, but the racism that is so much a part of what we deem as acceptable, where we stay silent now, where it's, you know, little jokes that involve race or little derogatory remarks if somebody cuts you off in traffic, or it's okay to start talking about property values diminishing as members of different races move into an all-white neighborhood, things like that, that they found overt racism to be abhorrent and said so. But on the other hand, there was this other conversation that was always going on.
So you went from not really buying into that acceptable racism, which again is a euphemism, to
I was in a breakdance group as a little girl a bunch of multicultural people.
Right. So how did you then end up being in a hate group?
Just before my 15th birthday, I went to a party with some friends. During that time, I was being drawn towards counterculture movements, skateboarders, and then from there, like punk rock. I never quite felt like I fit in my family. I felt like there was a lot of perfectionism that was part of my family that I never really could quite measure up. Real or perceived, that was how I felt in my family. And so I didn't have a deep, strong sense of belonging. And then we moved from where I had grown up outside of Philadelphia to rural Michigan, just over the border of Ohio. And I lost all sense of personal identity that I had been building since I was young, coupled with the fact that I didn't feel a strong connection and identity as part of my family. And so I started being drawn to like skateboard culture and then punk rock culture, like looking for identity outside of myself. I went to a party when I was 14, just shy of my 15th birthday. And at that party, I was raped by two men. And that was how I lost my virginity. It would take me another 10 years to even be able to frame what happened to me that way. I understand now how the brain deals with trauma and why that would be so. But instead of going to my parents, I knew on some level that if I told them that, that had happened, that I would be in trouble because I had lied about where I had gone and I had been drinking. And I know that the core of who I was couldn't accept that anyone placing blame on me for this outrage, for this trauma that had happened to me, that it wasn't my fault. And that began a cycle of deep self-loathing, and because I had all of this unprocessed trauma. And so I just began to just hate myself and my body and see myself as worthless and not having any value. And that would be a slow process, really, as that kind of took over like a sickness in my being. And then so about 6 months on down the road, I broke up with the first like real boyfriend that I had. And then, you know, and then it was like the anger consumed me. And I was already involved in the punk rock movement, and there were skinheads on the periphery of that. And they were the angriest people in this already sort of angry subculture. And so I was able to identify with their anger and was like, wow, those are my people. Those are the people I want to be around.
And it sounds
and
like
all
you're
you
saying,
had to do was be angry.
Right. And it sounds like what you're saying is that to fit in and become, as you say, angry, part of learning to hate other people was learned. That was part of fitting into that group. Is that accurate?
Yes, I believe that is accurate. And for me, it wasn't a big step because I hated everybody. And so in a strange way, it was almost a relief to make my anger and the rage that I felt smaller and more focused, that instead of just raging with everything and just all the time, it was like, well, all I have to do is say, join in and say, I hate black people. I hate Jews. I hate all non-white people. And so it would be a process of that, but that I understood that was the price of admission. And it was almost a relief because it took this big amorphous, ineffable rage that I felt and at least gave it a name.
That's former skinhead Shannon Martinez. She lives in Athens, Georgia. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. On Second Thought is 3 years old now. We went on the air in October of 2014, and we're celebrating by listening back to some of the best stories of the past 3 years. Let's get back to our conversation with former skinhead Shannon Martinez of Athens, Georgia, and Sammy Rangel, executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate. And again, a warning that this conversation may not be suitable for young people. So I want to play you this comment. This is a psychology professor from the University of Maryland named Ariai Kuglansky. And he's talking about why it's not a good idea to mock a skinhead or someone who is a white supremacist.
If you mock their beliefs, they're going to push back. There's going to be a blow up. There's going to be a boomerang effect. So you must be careful not to offend their beliefs. You have to reach out to them, listen to their concerns, and provide the alternative ways of thinking.
What do you make of that, that mocking is not the right approach?
I have seven kids, so I am able to toe the line of saying, hey, the behavior is unacceptable. Like, what you are doing and putting forth is not acceptable on any level. But let's talk about what you believe. Let me hear you and not talk past you and not belittle you, because you clearly have a reason that you believe so strongly about this that you're willing to, you know, join a rally in Charlottesville or wherever the rally might be, or engage online. Like, you clearly hold this belief dear to you. So instead of being like, wow, you're just a worthless piece of trash, very likely they already believe that. And saying that causes an embattlement. If you refuse to truly hear someone and where they're coming from, that the tendency is to become defensive almost immediately. And so it will be completely ineffective if you are truly trying to dialogue with someone, even with an abhorrent point of view, if you just mock and belittle them, and you will entrench them further. If shame is at the root and disconnection from others and a sense of objectifying other human beings is at the root, then objectifying the person with whom you're trying to dialogue just exacerbates the problem, and there's just a deepening cycle of disconnect from others.
Well, on that note, let's bring Sammy Rangel into the conversation. He's the executive director of Life After Hate, which is a nonprofit group that helps people move away from violent extremism. And Sammy joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Sammy.
Good morning.
So I want to play another comment from Ariai Kruglansky of the University of Maryland, a psychology professor, talking about the fact that people, just like Shannon, but people who are extremists are actually redeemable.
You know, radicalization is not a terminal disease. In the same way as a person gets radicalized, he or she can get de-radicalized, and they can also get re-radicalized. You know, the human psyche is a very fluid, malleable kind of entity.
So what do you make of this, Sammy? Because we're living in a time when people say there are some people you just can't talk to. What's your response to that?
Well, I would say you're talking to one right now, and, you know, our Formers Network within Life After Hate in other areas of work that I do is full of people who were deemed, diagnosed as incorrigible, antisocial, sociopathic, and many of the members of this group were the leaders and the faces of these hate groups, these extremely violent groups. And yet today, if you were to sit down with any one of us, if you didn't know our background, you would never guess. And if you did know our background, you might be amazed at the transition and the transformation that everyone has gone through and is going through in order to maintain that. And we're still seeing that trending coming with the people that are even newer to our organization, to our Formers group, that they are deeply in this process of transforming their narratives and their lifestyles. And in the way that they see that they need to give back to the community is second to none, if you ask me.
And we only have about a minute here, Sammy, before we take a short break. But do you agree with both Shannon that mocking is or shaming is not productive?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, we're noticing a trend that has reemerged where this collective shame may be contributing to some of the radical feelings and ideas that people are developing currently right now in the alt-right.
The number of people who think neo-Nazi views are acceptable has now doubled since Charlottesville. Shannon, why do you think that is?
I think a lot of that has to do with packaging and marketing. When these views, when confronted, the default position, as it was for me over 20 years ago, as it is today, is that, well, we're not really racist. We want to have everyone to have their own little areas where they live and where, you know, like where we don't think we're better than people of other races. We just want to have our own little space where we get to just do white people things, and we don't, and everyone can do their own ethnic things in their own little area, and it's not really about racism. And at the same time, they also say, well, you know, there's Black Pride and Black Lives Matter. Don't our lives matter too? Don't we count for something? And people resonate with that because they don't really understand what the arguments truly are. Because what the argument really is we're white and we're better and we don't want to be polluted, so to speak, by the ongoings of people that don't look like us.
Shannon Martinez is a former skinhead. She now volunteers to help others leave hate groups. And Sammy Rangel is the executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. For our third anniversary, we're listening back to some of the best conversations of the past 3 years. One of our most popular segments is the Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to choose two songs they think best represent our state. The songs have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians cannot choose their own stuff. So, let's listen back to a couple of picks from one of Georgia's most beloved musicians. Killer Mike is half of the rap duo Run the Jewels and founder of Grind Time Official Records. Here are his picks for the playlist.
My name is Michael Render. Professionally, I'm known as Killer Mike, and I am a rapper. I'm a part of a group called Run the Jewels. They don't dance no more. They don't dance no more. I'm based out of Atlanta, Georgia. My rap partner is based out of Brooklyn, New York, and we managed to make beautiful music together. Yeah, get it, done it, run it, say it how you want it, leave it when you're finished, left it, dress it up and made it seem sweet. The first song that I'm going to pick that I like by a Georgia artist is They Don't Dance No More by Goody Mob. Going left to right, throwing bones like the pro, burning lows up in the night, feeling numb from the cup I drank. Goody Mob and Atlanta had been kind of put in a place of, you're Miami part two. You're not quite Uncle Luke or DJ Magic Mike out of Orlando. You're like, you guys are pretty good at the dance music. You know, it was like Scrub the Ground and Whoop That Is. And those kind of fun dance records were dominating, but Goody were saying things, you know what I'm saying? And they put it over a beat that you could juke to and groove to and afterwards, you know, talk about. So for me, you know, it was just that they moved your mind and your booty. They, you know, they made the top half and the bottom half shake. That record from Goody is one of my favorites because it not only was a dope rap record, it was an amazingly good dance record that I traveled through all the, you know, the 559s, the Gates, you know, just those type of clubs that college kids were going to. It was that juke that was in 559. It was the juke joint. It was the sweaty chitlin circuit moving. And it really helped me, that record really helped me understand what now Run the Jewels is. You know, we are a group that could be considered heavy, that could be considered intense, but our shows are fun. People are moshing, but they're smiling. They're wowing, but they're dancing. There's a fevered exhausting of energy that needed to get burned off. And I understood about Goody that I needed those records from them as much as I needed soul food, as much as I needed In the Ghetto, as much as I needed those records to get me through anger and pain. I needed celebratory records from artists I loved. So that's one of them. And I don't think Goody Mob is as heralded as they should be. The second song I like to pick is the Allman Brothers, Whipping Post. I'll smoke a joint at the crib and just watch a whole hour of Allman Brothers or listen to them. They did a festival here, but I listen to that whole performance at least once or twice a week. You know, I've been run down. I've been lied to. I don't know why. You know, I let that mean woman make a fool. She took all my money, wrecked my new car. Now she's with one of my good time buddies. They're drinking at some crosstown bar. If you're, first of all, if you're Southern, you know what a whipping post is. If that's not the blues, what is? Like, as a man, you know, I'd like to feel like I've been an alpha male in every relationship. And, man, if my wife left me the day, I'd be curled up in a corner, you know, crying. You know what I'm saying? And I know, you know, as a man, you don't know what it feels like to hurt till you've been heartbroken, man. You know, and the blues let you know that. Like, think about when you hear, sometimes I feel, you know, like I've been tied to the whipping post. Good Lord, I feel like I'm dying. I felt like that. Me and my wife went through a hard part. You know, she wasn't a woman running around on me,
You know, I made some wrong decisions at some point in our marriage, and man, she put me out. That might have been the worst year of my life. Now, Allman Brothers is just what I play, man, to kind of get me in the mood before a show. Before I go on stage and rap, I'm probably going to play some Allman Brothers or some Zeppelin or some Sabbath. You know, those guys aren't from Georgia, but I feel like they were influenced by the blues, so I had to say it. But the Allman Brothers, they're just amazing. Every time I go through Macon, my wife's from Savannah, every time we hit the Macon line, Allman Brothers comes on. Like, I'm playing it. You know, I'm playing it till we get all the way down 16. Is there a sound that defines Georgia? Yeah, it's called Organized Noise Productions. If you want to hear what Georgia was, what Georgia is, and what Georgia can and will be, you're talking about music and instrumentation. You're talking about lyricisms that have grain and grit to them. You're talking about the Dungeon Family. You're talking about Organized Noise. Because you're going to hear the South. You're going to hear soul in the music. You're going to hear Curtis Mayfield. You're going to hear Little Richard. You're going to hear James Brown. You're going to hear Dre, Big, you know, me, CeeLo. And I don't mean just me in the literal. You're going to hear Future. You know, you're going to, you know, all the people I'm naming are members of the Dungeon Family, you know, in terms of the rappers. It's like, it's just a soul, man. You can't even describe it. It's just literally just a soul. Like, I can't tell you why Wu-Tang Clan is so much better than so many other groups who tried to be them. They got it. Whatever that soul is, they got it. And, you know, whatever the soul is that Dungeon Family had and helped impart on me, I'm happy for it, because it really does give you a sense of what Georgia feels like.
That's Killer Mike of Run the Jewels. Of course, if you want to nominate a song for inclusion on the playlist, tweet us at OST Talk or post on our Facebook page. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Friday is this show's third anniversary, so we're taking a couple of days to listen to some of the best conversations over our history. Colin Mochrie may have one of the fastest minds around. The comedian is best known for his role on Whose Line Is It Anyway? But audiences in Atlanta sometimes get to see him in action at Dad's Garage. We spoke to Colin back in August before his performances here.
Good morning.
When did you first suspect you might be good at improv? Like, when did you first think, hey, this is my niche?
Oh, well, there wasn't a time. When I was growing up, it didn't exist. So it wasn't until I first saw improv, some friends were demonstrating, and I thought, oh, this will be interesting to try out. You don't really have to learn anything. You just make up crap. I can do that. And I took a workshop and found that I really had an affinity for it. And so it just became something I loved doing, and I never thought, oh, this is going to be my career. So it's really worked out nicely for me.
I mean, obviously, you have to practice and rehearse improv quite a lot, which seems antithetical, but it's not. But do you think an improvisation pro is born or made?
Oh, well, I think anyone can do improv. I mean, all our lives are improvised. So basically, the two rules are doing the things that we don't do in real life, which is listening and accepting other people's ideas. That is the hardest hurdle for new improvisers to get over. There's that thing, and that's where, no, my idea is better. And once you learn to let that go, you can be a good improviser. I think the humor aspect, I think you're born with it. I don't think anyone, classes could make you funnier. They can't make you funny. You have to have that, I think, to begin with.
Let's hear from the late comic Del Close. He's often called the father of long-form improv. He played a big role in forming Second City. Here he is speaking in 1970. He's talking to the legendary journalist Studs Terkel and explaining why he thinks improv is more than just sketch comedy.
The theater of psychology, the theater of feeling, is very much on the way out. And it's only through action that we understand someone, not through what they tell us about themselves. No soliloquy is going to reveal nearly so much about what the guy does as what he does after the soliloquy, what the guy's like, rather. And that's what I'm trying to get to in improvisation as well.
So how do you, when you're practicing improv, how do you balance the verbal, what you're saying, and you're so good at the one-liners, right, mm-hmm. with the physicality that he's talking about?
You know, it all depends on the scene. You know, most of the, I don't really practice improv. What I do is try to get to a state where I'm just totally relaxed on walking out onto a stage in front of an audience who have paid good money to see a show that I don't have at that moment. So you're open to everything that comes along. And then your body and mind go into sort of a survival mode where you start physicalizing. Very, like, even the smallest moment can get a laugh and get an audience to go, I know that movement, I know that person, I know that situation. It just becomes an organic thing that you and your partners sort of start to breathe together and make this living scene. It's such a bizarre art form because it truly just lasts for that moment. If you saw someone say, you know, I saw this really funny show last night, the guy walked like a duck. And you go, well, what? You had to be there to see the entire process and why that was funny at that moment. It really is such a, it's like a firefly or something. It just lives for that 2 hours and then it's gone forever.
Although there are people who watch reruns of Whose Line Is It Away endlessly. Here's a pretty popular sketch. One of the sketches that you did numerous times on that show was where you played a news anchor, and each time you had a different name. Here are a few of those names.
Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Arthur Any More Donuts. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Earl from Ipanema. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Wolverine St. Jack John. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Lars of the Red Hot Lovers.
You shook your head.
It's just sad when you hear them all in a row. Oh, the career is gone now.
Just joining me, I'm speaking with comedian Colin Mockery. I mean, do you often go back and listen to improvisation or sketches that you've done?
No. There are times where I'll be, you know, clicking channels and I'll see a Whose Line and watch it. And it's I'm watching as an audience because I have no memory of that particular scene. The only one, and now I don't know if I know it because I remember, or I've just seen it so many times, is the Richard Simmons scene where I use him as a jet ski that... Yet to be there.
Well, actually, we have a little clip of that also. We first hear Drew Carey introducing everyone.
Let's continue the show with a game called, I love this game, Living Scenery. This is for Ryan, Colin, and Wayne. And Richard Simmons, everybody. Richard Simmons. Ryan and Colin are going to act out a scene. During the scene, they have to use a number of props. However, since they don't have any real props to work with
I'll
tonight.
I'll be the prop.
Right, Wayne and Richard.
He was so committed.
Yes.
You've got to love that.
What makes a good partner in improv? I mean, you've already said somebody who listens and responds, right? Mm-hmm. Is that basically all that you need?
That's it. And trust, someone that you totally trust. You know, I work with Ryan Stiles a lot, and I tour with Brad Sherwood. Both those guys, I usually know where they're going to go in a scene. But when I don't, I trust them both enough to just follow along and see what's going to happen. So trust is a big part.
So when you're doing improv, I mean, improv, I assume, is a relative, based on whatever shows I've been to, they seem to be a relatively diverse crowd of, mm-hmm. of people. And I wonder how you deal then with controversial subjects, or if you steer away from them. It's hard these days because almost everything becomes political, right?
Yeah.
But do you hesitate before you bring up a joke or a line that might be controversial?
We try. Brad Sherwood and I have been touring for 15 years. And lately, we've actually started off the show saying, we would like to keep this a political-free show. We're just doing goofy stuff. So please, let's not mention just the current events. Because I don't know, in an improv setting, we can... bring justice to what the suggestion is. You know, there are so many great satirical, political satirists out there who can make a point. Our thing would be, well, this is stupid. And then it'd be hard to sort of build on that. And it's not what we do. We're just there to have goofy fun. We throw little things out. But we started to notice during the Bush administration, there was one night Brad made a totally innocuous Bush joke, and the audience was immediately divided in half. And it was like, wow, how did this happen? Americans love making fun of their presidents. And it's just gotten actually worse since then. So we made this choice, just let's keep away from it. It's not what our show is mainly about, and it's really not worth it for that one little moment to suddenly split up our audience.
Actor and comedian Colin Mochrie.